Yeah, I don't know.
Do you have much of what you produce in those days other than what's in the reports? You save your memoranda?
Well, I used to have it, but the 25 years or so since I was there, I'd look for it. I have it in two places. I surely don't have it easily available, but I...
On a longer-term basis, and I would encourage you, if I may, to consider whether if this is lying around somewhere, and here's a repository for it.
Yeah, one other thing that my clerk, Mike Stafford, who's a lawyer in Lansing, found was that I had the highest persuasion rate of any of the justices in terms of the percentage of the cases that I wrote that became majority of you. I was in the 80% group, and I think the next justice was up to 77, mm-hmm. which is both of which are pretty good. And I analyze it this way. You could say, well, oh boy, here's a guy who really is overwhelming his colleagues. That wasn't true. I think for reasons we already discussed, I probably picked up votes because I didn't write with any particular personality, flair, or color. Didn't want to, and also that made it easier for judges to agree with you. The other thing was that I think, although I used to consider myself a kind of a leading hard liberal, I think as it turned out, when I came to face issues, that I probably wound up in the middle of the court. I was neither conservative, or I was probably more liberal than I was. I'm sure a lot of people would say that. But I was more of a kind of a moderate liberal, I guess. If you focus on that and you think you're going to build a reputation that way, you're going to be a bad judge. What you got to do is call him as you see him and let the chips fall where they may, and then you find out later on what you are. By what you've done, yeah. And then you say, "Oh, was I liberal? Well, I must have been. Or was I moderate liberal, or whatever?" But I think that I satisfied myself that the reason I had a persuasion rate that high was because I probably philosophically fell somewhere towards the middle of the court rather than on the left, so to speak.
Do you remember the case? I'm sure you do. Where there was a dispute involved some 5,000 Flint auto workers. I think the name of the case was Stinson. There'd been a strike in Ohio. These fellows were thrown out.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? Well, okay. But part of it that I want to have you recall is you disqualified yourself first time around because you had ownership, and there were two others on the court disqualified.
Sirs
and Adams had been as attorney general involved. I think he disqualified for that reason, I think. Now, do you recall what happened there? Where?
I think at that time we were thinking in absolute terms if we had any interest at all, and I had nine shares.
Was it eight? I thought you told me eight one time, but you said under 10. You said under 10.
Yeah, when I was at Public Service Commission, I became interested in stocks for the first time in my life, really interested, because I had so much to do with it in rate cases, dealing with the rates of return, and I was looking at stocks. So I remember buying some DuPont after the first opinion was announced in the DuPont case requiring DuPont to divest itself of the 23% interest it held in General Motors. And I remember all the caterwauling about that will destroy not only DuPont and General Motors, but that decision will destroy the stock market. And I said, oh boy, that's overstated. So making long story short, I bird-dogged the DuPont stock as it fell from middle $250, $200-something a share, down to about $168 a share, and it started back up, and I grabbed off 10 whole shares for $174.50 a share. And when the divestiture became final, I not only was able to sell my DuPont, I think for something like $230 a share, but in the divestiture I got almost a share of GM for every share of DuPont I had owned. And at the time I was holding that, I think, eight or nine shares of GM. And the thinking was that if you had a stock interest in a major corporation, you wouldn't participate in these cases. But